Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 169 on investing in real estate using an IRA with Jason DeBono. If you are into real estate investing and building wealth, congratulations, you are in the right place. My role here on the REI Diamond Show is to invite guests who specialize in building wealth, such as real estate investors and other industry service providers, and to draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. So one of the key reasons that my company, Diamond Equity Investments, has grown to closing more than 200 deals per year is the private bank strategy. And today's guest, Jason, joins us to discuss the strategy, that private bank strategy, that investors are using where they construct their own private bank using money sourced from the IRA accounts of people that are already in your network to fund fix and flip deals. So the IRA owner, the investor in the private bank scenario, enjoys the high yield provided by the fix and flip investor, usually around 10%, you know, a little less, a little more, plus some points, while the fix and flip investor is able to operate a larger number of deals with the additional access to capital. It's a true win-win. It drives the real estate fix and flip business throughout the entire U.S. Jason and I also discuss several unique deal examples, including my first ever private money funded fix and flip deal so many years ago. If you're currently flipping houses and have not yet mastered the use of self-directed IRA money for your deals, you're about to discover the most abundant source of private money in the U.S. It's a game changer. Or on the flip side, if you currently have an old IRA from previous employer job, you just saved it up, and you'd love to see that IRA account produce higher returns or maybe more consistent returns than it's currently producing, Jason covers the method that many investors have been using to do just that. Please note my disclaimer, neither Jason or myself are providing investment, legal, or tax advice during this episode. We are not professional investment advisors. Any strategies or examples discussed here are provided from our own investing and business activities. If you're seeking legal, tax, or investing advice, I suggest you consult with the appropriate licensed professional. With that out of the way, let's get on to the show. All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. Jason, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing well. So we usually location stamp these at the beginning. I'm in Chicago, and you are recording from in the U.S. or world?
I am in sunny Florida, just outside of Orlando.
Nice, nice. Yeah, we had a nice day shaping up here late in the afternoon in Chicago, which is, it was like snowing, I think, this time last year, but it's like 68 degrees here out the window now. But you guys are spoiled. You get that weather all the time.
Well, this is the time of the year that all the Floridians really start to brag about living in Florida. I think on the tail end of the obnoxious heat and starting to enter in the few months of just gorgeous fall weather.
Yeah, I'm probably putting it in my calendar for like January 10th to maybe get down there for a week or a month or something like that. So I'll wait till it's like prime season before I head on down.
Yeah, it's amazing how many due diligence requests that people have from January to the end of February that come from up north. So we love it, and we love being here certainly through the fall and winter.
Nice, nice. So, all right, cool. For listeners who might not know who you are, Jason, do you want to kind of give a little bit of a background and what you do in real estate and what your function is in the industry today?
Sure. I'm the vice president of Newview Trust Company. We're a third-party custodial firm that holds retirement accounts that invest outside the stock market, so into Main Street investments like real estate. I've been here a little over 15 years, and it's been great professionally, but it's also been great personally, as it's afforded me the ability to really learn and understand how people make money in real estate and real estate related investments. So I've done a good bit of private lending over the last 15 years. I've done a handful of real estate deals, both buy and hold as well as fix and flip. And I've partnered off on a variety of some more unique deals as they've come across my desk. But for the most part, private lending and real estate's been my personal investment bread and butter over the last 15 years.
Nice. You had mentioned something there in the introduction, but you said it a little more detailed before we got on our call and started the recorder here for the audience to hear. And that was, it was something along the lines of like, hey, it's funny how being in my position, meaning you, and seeing all the deal flow at NewView over time, and you're like, it's amazing how the real money is made in real estate versus how mainstream people think the money's made in real estate. Would you mind going into a little bit of detail of that observation and the perspective of how it really is versus maybe the mainstream idea of real estate investing?
Yeah, I appreciate that question because it's something that, you know, over the years has really changed kind of my viewpoint. When I started with NewView, you know, I always viewed real estate investments really through the lens of my dad as you know, having done real estate investing, you know, growing up. And it was always kind of buy a house and rent it out. And every, you know, 12 to 24 months, you go and rip the urine infested carpet out and clean it up and bring in the new tenant. And, you know, I kind of always viewed that was how real estate was done. It's just the way that it works, and you buy it and you rent it and eventually you sell it. And what I had no real clue on is, you know, what fix and flips were, to, you know, as an idea. I had no idea what private lending was, that you could be a real estate investor and have all the, you know, benefits of, you know, collateral from a real estate standpoint, but not actually own the property. I had no idea that there were ways that you could engage in real estate transactions without ever physically owning the property, like wholesaling properties. You know, I had no idea that you could joint venture, like there were people out there that would do all the legwork and I can just passively invest. So I'm not the one ripping carpet out when the tenants move out. So, you know, it really opened my eyes very quickly to understand that, man, this real estate, you know, model is not just a kind of a one and done type opportunity. And there's nothing wrong with the buy and hold rental model. I have some rental property, you know, because I think it is a good long-term strategy, but you know, it's really been it's been cool to see and rewarding personally to kind of understand how that works and how people really take advantage of all the different strategies around real estate and related investing.
Yeah, and that's spot on. It's so ironic that you talk about that. So when I was like a real little kid, my grandpa died. Maybe I was 7 or 8 years old, I think. And so I remember a little bit of like his property management in the city of Philadelphia. Like we would go down and watch I think it's the Mummers Parade. It's kind of the New Year's Parade in Philly. And he would have like vacant units right along the parade route. And it was freezing cold in there. But we would look right out the window, and it was better than being on the street to watch the parade at that time. But like, I remember doing that, and it was the buy it and rent it kind of a model. And he didn't actually own it. He was like a property manager, I think, for like the Archdiocese or something like that. But then my dad around that same time, he was buying a house and he would fix it up and then they would rent it out. And I don't think they were actually selling any of them. So they got to like 3 or 4, the partners had a riff, and that was the end of my dad in real estate. So I was like you, Jason, I had the thought that, oh yeah, this is how you do real estate. You buy this, you know, junker of a house, you spend like 3, 4, 5 months a year fixing it up and then you rent it out. And like when I did the numbers back then, the numbers like hands down kicked the ass of my paper route that I was running with like a whole lot less effort once the rent started coming in. And I knew way back then that was like my dream was to get into real estate and flip a house. And for me, it was like coming from a place of no money. So I had no money and I didn't know about these other models. Luckily, my dad did pull the trigger on this like $10,000, you know, seminar program. They were big and they're probably still big out there. But in 2006, when we went, it seemed like they were everywhere with the real estate boom going on. And they had talked about those same kind of things you did, the JV, right? And you talked about being a passive side of the JV. But like a couple of my first deals with a partner who I'm still in business with today, I was the source of deals. Like I had no money, Jason. So like, where was Dan Breslin going to bring something of value to the table in the real estate industry, right? It's kind of like on the other side, all right, you got money, you're going to fund some deals, you're going to fund some flips, you're going to fund some JVs. So I landed on the idea of becoming the source of deals, and like no one in the industry was going to find more deals than Dan Breslin was going to find. And still to this day, that's kind of our cutting edge here. I mean, we did 201 deals year to date right now. We've got 158 more in our inventory as we speak. We did 223 last year. And that all stemmed from my honing in on and locking in on being the source of deals. And it's a big team. There's probably 25 partners now in part of the company. But back to the lending piece, right? And this is a point I'm getting around to here in a roundabout way. I had no money, and we were at those seminars way back when, and they were teaching us about fixing and flipping and the discount you need, and here's how you make the offer and all that. So I'm going to teach you how to get the money for the flips. You want to create a private bank. So, that sounds nice. Yeah, a private bank. And then essentially, that was the first time that I had heard that you could raise money from people who had money in IRAs that was kind of sitting dormant from old jobs. A guy's 200,000, a gal has, you know, 250,000, and it's from some job she left 10 years ago. It's just sitting there in the market, right? And they don't know what to do with it. It's kind of hanging out there until they retire maybe. And the theory behind the private bank was, you know, you make a business almost on your own personal investing business of, you know, establishing the relationships. Maybe it's people you already know. And then you're sort of connecting the dots education-wise, right? You're bringing to the table the knowledge of the self-directed IRA, and maybe you'll be able to put a little more detail on this, but essentially go out, find 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people, and now you've accessed, you know, 500,000, million, whatever it is, by kind of connecting the dots for that lender to become the passive side of the equation flipping. If you're the active side, which I was the person who brought the deal to the table, and I would run the fix and flip, and I would sell the property, and then I'd pay off, you know, I pay 10% and 2 points to my private lenders. I still do that to this day. But I was the active side. I know a lot of people in the audience are the active side, and setting up a private bank would be a huge game changer. Would you mind maybe touching on what the conversation would look like for an investor who's fixing and flipping deals now, and they know somebody who has this IRA from, you know, their old job that's sitting dormant? Like, what would that conversation look like to engage a custodian like yourself, your company, NewView, and this potential private lender to kind of put the pieces together so that they could flip more property and really take the limits off of their business?
Well, you hit on kind of the biggest challenge that real estate investors will come across, and that is capital. And, you know, any good investor, regardless of how much capital they have access to, will always want more capital, right? More capital, more deals. And, you know, the way that real estate investing becomes a business is when it's scaled, right? To your point of doing 200 deals, that's a business. If you did two, it's not really a business. You probably need a day job, and you're just a passive investor. And so finding money is, no matter what stage you are in your investment career, is critical. And finding money that you can tap into that's patient, long-term money is a really a strategy that should be, you know, considered and executed on. So, you know, when we talk about how do you go get money, well, the first-time investors and kind of new or novice investors, you know, they're going to scrape their savings, they're going to ask some people they know, and all those things are good and great. But if you want to scale, you need a bank. And you could go to a traditional bank, but depending on the deals that you're doing, you know, you're not going to be able to work through a traditional bank long, because you're going to exceed any capital they're going to extend, especially when you start looking at properties that are in disrepair or properties that need to close in a couple of days. It just doesn't fit the model of a traditional bank. You have the opportunity to go to private, you know, hard money lenders. The problem is that can be expensive. And then you've got to go through a little bit more robust underwriting every time, and the goalposts can move, and they may be tapped out of cash, et cetera. So, you know, when we talk about this kind of private bank model, it's really geared around identifying as many people as you need in your arsenal and in your group that you can build trust with over time. So, you know, the thing that we start with is you've got to have that discussion with these potential lenders. And there's no great way to do that. Obviously, the way that feels most comfortable to you is the one you should deploy. But it really starts with the introduction to what you do and why you do it and how you do it and the opportunity that that lends. So, for example, you know, Dan, I may say, hey, Dan, we've been friends for a long time. I don't know if you're familiar with, you know, the fact that I'm a real estate investor, that I'm getting into real estate, and here's how I've been making money. You know, and I'd love for you to be able to kind of join me in that journey. And here's a way that you can, you know, proactively participate with me in a passive manner. And then that question of if you're intrigued by, you know, earning 10% or 12%, you know, in 2 points, depending on the market that you live in and what the market bears, you know, that's an opportunity to create that dialogue. And once you understand what I do, Dan, then it's the time for me to say, hey, it may even be easier for you and actually be more advantageous for you to write that loan out of your IRA. And the reason that you want to start that dialogue from an IRA standpoint is it's patient money. Right? If Dan, you know, becomes my private lender and he's got $100,000 in cash, which not a lot of people do outside their IRA anyways, that money may be needed to pay for kids' college or other things that can transpire. Whereas if you gave me the same $100,000 from an IRA, you're not touching it for 10, 15 years, so I know that as long as I'm a good steward of it, you're going to keep coming back for more and more. As I pay off a deal, you see that you made good money, you're going to be begging me to do the next deal. So patient money is the best, and IRAs represent generally the average individual's highest amount of liquid net worth because it's going to likely be held in some sort of public security that can simply be sold and transferred over to a custodian like NewView and then lent out to, in this case, Jason, to go do a deal. And the goal for all of us is to successfully do as many real estate deals as we can over the years. And I make my money on the real estate side and you make your money on the lender side.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, patient money is best, right? I've made the mistake of borrowing money from somebody who had no business whatsoever lending the money. And then, you know, he's calling me back like 9 weeks later in a panic, telling me give me the money back. Like, you got to give it back now. And so, you know, finding the right person to do the loan. I'll share my own resource here. So when people are listening to our show, accredited investors are who we borrow money from. So that has a meaning to it and people would know who that is. But you could see kind of my landing page, if you will, if you go to fundrehabdeals.com. And we have document examples of some of the note mortgage and kind of the process, right? And that's how I communicate with my lenders. And so like anybody listening wants to do the same, you can sign up for the list and kind of kick tires on it. And see how I present that. And it kind of might give you some ideas for your own pitching, if you will, of your rehab business. And one other piece I'll share too, and then we'll kind of shift gears here a little bit, is if you're already rehabbing properties, it's really a difficult proposition early on. If you've never flipped a house and you're going to go have that conversation that Jason just mentioned with somebody, it's going to be, I mean, if it's, you know, if it's mom or dad or it's like your aunt, you got like a real strong personal relationship there and they're ready to take that gamble on you and together, it's probably, you know, a doable kind of a thing. For me, I found that wasn't even doable early on either, right? And until I had, you know, 4 or 5 deals, 10 deals, 20 deals, 30 deals. Once you have a volume of deals that you can create like a pitch book, a presentation book, right? A binder, you got your before photos on the left-hand side of the page. You got the identical after photos of the product, the project that you've completed there on the right-hand side of the page. And you turn that over and the next page is like your purchase HUD showing the price that you paid for the house. And the next page is the sale HUD showing where your private lender from that deal got paid off X amount of dollars, you know, at the closing table, and you kind of show the profit to that, you know, to that potential new lender. You show the actual profit on your deal by doing the math there, and maybe put your note and your mortgage in there. And so you kind of want to create like a presentation piece to have the conversation with new people. But early on, let's assume you have zero experience. You found a great deal. I think for me, what opened the door for me to get my first loan that ever came from a private lender out of his IRA was, you know, the first deal, I assigned it to the guy. He was already in real estate. The second deal, I brought it to him. I was like, I got this project, you know, this property. It's under contract for $115,000, whatever it was. let's do this. You know, this was my first JV deal. You're going to bring the cash. You're going to close on it in your LLC. We'll do a piece of paper that says we're going to split the profit 50-50. This house didn't actually need much. It was a hot market 2006, and we sold it as a handyman special. And that was the plan. We're going to sell it for $160,000, you know, as is, and we're just going to keep it moving. And we did pretty much that, and we shared the profit. But that was kind of my breaking the ice, if you will, to then on the fourth deal that I did my entire career, that same gentleman lent me the money, and then we kind of had this relationship. Maybe it was JV sometimes, maybe I was flipping sometimes, maybe sometimes I was assigning the deal to him, and we've done a ton of business since then. But the bottom line, quick, easy takeaway for someone who doesn't have a ton of experience and can't put the pitch book together, you got to get that first one under your belt. And a good way to do that might be bringing the deal to the table and not even taking a 50-50 split with someone with, you know, more experience who will kind of, you know, let you call this project your own, take pictures, get you to HUDs, close on it, allow you to complete the project so that you start to now have a bit of a resume to borrow more money. Cool. So, Jason, let's switch gears here just a little bit, and let's talk about different types of retirement accounts that somebody could have or should be aware of. Like, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think there's a way for me as an investor to actually pay for my daughter's college education by setting up a certain type of account. Are there other unique accounts that you would have a conversation with a client that that anyone listening would think would be like really valuable and eye-opening?
Yeah, you hit on the educational savings account, which is one of my favorite accounts that exists. You know, when we talk about plan types, I think what happens is, you know, people want to save as little as they have to, and nobody wants to put money away. It's just the human nature. When you kind of get over that and realize that, yeah, the more I save, the better off I'll be later, you start to really understand that the government gives us lots of tools to save. And, you know, I'm a big believer in there's a big difference between making money and building wealth. And, you know, the average person tries to make money, and wealthy people don't try to make money. They try to build wealth. And that's coupling both good earnings and investments with good tax strategy. And so IRAs really create that tax strategy for you, and they're readily available. You don't need a team or arsenal of accountants, you know, on speed dial that tell you what to do, but rather you take advantage of these very black and white, readily available tools. So when we talk about retirement accounts, that's what gets you to retirement. And there's a few different ways to get there. I think the only thing I'll highlight here that's different is the difference between a traditional account and a Roth. Because I think it's something that most people choose traditional because that's what they've always chosen. And I'd encourage everyone to strongly consider the Roth. It basically says pay the tax up front. Whatever you earn is tax-free over the life of that account. So when you talk about 20, 30, 40 years of tax-free growth, I don't care how much you charge me in tax today. I'm going to win the game if I got 20, 30, 40 years of tax-free growth. So I'd encourage everybody to take a look at the Roth no matter where you are, you know, from an income standpoint. Even if it seems expensive today, it will pale in comparison if you're a good steward of the money. The second thing I'd encourage everyone that's on the call that's self-employed or has some form of self-employed earnings, even if you do have a full-time W-2 job, is to look at what we call the solo QRP. It's referred to as a solo 401k, but the solo QRP is really like creating your own business 401k plan against your self-employed earnings. So it mimics, you know, what it looks like to work for AT&T while working for yourself. And that plan has great contribution limits. It has a lot of benefits outside of what you can invest into. You get better control over it. So I'd encourage everyone to take a look at that. That's another form of retirement plan. And then you've got two what we call special purpose plans. They're not designed to give you tax advantage savings for retirement. They're tied. One is to education and one is to health. So you already mentioned that kind of educational savings account. This is one of my favorite plans. It's basically a Roth IRA for education. You get no tax benefit to put the money in. However, every dollar that you earn inside that account is 100% tax-free when used for qualifying educational expenses. And then the HSA is a health savings account. If you have a high deductible health insurance plan, This is a way to save for your health expenses 100% tax-free. And these both of these plans can be put into real estate. All the earnings come back into the plan 100% tax-free. And you can really amass good wealth and now create this environment where you can pay for your kids' college education 100% tax-free. And you can do it with earnings rather than just principal. So definitely plans worth looking into. I could go on and on about them, but for the sake of time, I won't. I'll just leave it with this, and that is, if you want to build wealth, you should be putting money into every single tax advantage program through IRAs or HSAs or ESAs that exist, because it is the only way to both earn money, which is the investment side, and keep more of what you earn, which is how you truly build wealth.
Love it. Let's play out an example here. So let's go with our education savings account. And you can put how much in there each year, or how much would you typically start? Is there a limit that you would put into that ESA account?
ESAs are capped at $2,000 a year.
Right. And so devil's advocate, right? This is where someone's mind might go here. Okay, so $2,000 a year. Like, geez, the kid's 18. I barely put $36,000 a year. I haven't even paid for 1 year of college there. What would be a creative way for somebody to put, you know, $2,000 into an ESA account and then find a way to quickly do deals in that account with such a limited amount of capital? Like, what's one creative way that someone has, you know, multiplied that $2,000 into something substantial to pay for someone's college?
Well, there's a couple ways to get there, and that's the beauty of kind of how these accounts are set up. And I'll tell you exactly what I've done. I have a 9-year-old, and we have an ESA for him. I have an HSA against my insurance plan, and then I also have a full 401k plan here at NewView that allows me to buy real estate. When I started the ESA and the HSA about 9 years ago on the ESA and about 10 years ago on the HSA, when I started those, I had very little money in them, but I had about 5 years of a jump start on my 401k. The beauty is you can partner those accounts alongside each other. So one of the first deals that we did was I did a loan. I partnered off with two other people. Now, this was in 2009, if I kind of memory serves me right. Hard money was very hard to come by. It was the best deal I think I've ever come across. But we did a loan at 15%, and we did it at 2 points. And it was a great deal for the buyer because it was, you know, rock bottom prices. They needed money. They had to short sell a few houses. So traditional financing wasn't an option. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but I had about $40,000-something in my 401k. I had $4,000 in my son's ESA because I was able to do that. And this was actually 2011 or 12, I think it was, but I was able to do 2 year contributions back to back. So I could contribute at the tail end of 2011 and very early in 2012. And then I had probably $6,000 or $8,000 in my HSA. And so I invested with another party and I own maybe 30% of the loan in my 401k and 7% in my HSA and, you know, 6% or 5% in my son's ESA. And that generated 15% plus 2 points. Other deals that I've done is I've done some wholesaling deals with partners, and I've thrown in $1,000 into the deal out of the ESA, and we've flipped the property and we, you know, kicked back $8,000 into the ESA. So, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot, but once you do that a couple of times, you start to now have capital inside these accounts to go out and really engage in some bigger, more aggressive investments. But the strategy of partnering on deals is great. Wholesaling, you know, and partnering on more quick hit type investments, especially ones where you can put as little possible money in, those can all represent great strategies.
Yeah, I think the wholesale one, right? It's eye opening for me. I haven't heard the partner the accounts together. That's a pretty interesting one. So that way you have all these different buckets, right? You just described three that you had set up. If you had multiple children, I assume you'd have, you know, multiple ESAs. Like, the list could get long. So that would be one way to capitalize on it and get them all kind of pumping together at whatever percentage that the hard money loan, you're the private lender in that instance. But man, the wholesale, if you could steer a bunch of wholesale deals into the IRAs, I mean, that's a way to quickly generate the capital. That's cool. So Jason, did any of the recent CARES Act adjust, take away, or add any benefits for investors, you know, in IRAs or otherwise that you would highlight?
Yeah, they're more universal. They're not necessarily specific to, you know, self-directed accounts, but they're general. If you're over 70 and a half or 72, depending on the year in which you turn 70 and a half, you don't have to take a minimum distribution from your account this year. If you have a 401k plan, your loan provision that went from 50,000 is now 100 grand. If you have an inherited IRA that had a distribution requirement, that's waived for the year. But one of the things that we have seen that has been pretty interesting is that there's an ability to withdraw from your 401k or your IRA up to $100,000 and then repay it back to the account tax-free and penalty-free. And normally you can only do that in very unique situations for only 60 days. And that's now good for 3 years. So you could, in theory, take 100 grand out of your IRA as long as you meet the qualification, right, of financial need or some sort of COVID-related distribution. And you could use that money personally for the next 3 years. And then as long as you put it back by the end of year three, it's completely tax and penalty free. So it gives you some kind of unfettered personal use of your IRA money. I'm not a fan of that because if you take it out of the IRA and you invest it and it makes money, while you get to keep it, you got to pay tax on it, and you might as well make the investment in the IRA and not pay the tax. But situations may prevail on your decision process there. But something that we have seen that the CARES Act has kind of opened up is we've seen 401ks, while you're actively employed, you're unable to take the money out. It's just the way that 401ks work. With the CARES Act, if you're actively employed, so maybe I work at AT&T, I can take up to 100 grand out, right, as long as I have the appropriate need for it. And then I have up to 3 years to put it back, but I don't have to wait 3 years. So if I've got 100 grand locked in a 401k at AT&T that can only buy into, you know, managed mutual fund products, that's all the plan allows, I can take a CARES Act distribution, assuming that I meet the criteria, and then I could turn around once that financial need is gone, maybe it's in a week or a month, and I can contribute that right into an IRA, now giving me the ability to go self-directed. And that's a pretty powerful tool to access some of that 401k money.
Yeah, it's interesting. I kind of have the same feeling as you. It's like, man, you did all of that work to not touch, not access that money for all that time for it to pile up. I think it would be just a tempting thing for someone. Take it out for the 3 years. What use is going to occur with the money during that 3 year period? I mean, obviously it's to cover bills and it's kind of like this life traumatic event is why they put it there. But man, I just feel like a lot of people will take the money and it's never going to make its way back in and there's going to be a tax bill at the end. But we'll say everyone listening and all of our clients, Jason, are highly responsible individuals and they're really great investors and they're not going to screw the pooch on 100K. IRAs, in my experience, borrowing from them, doing the paperwork, like it's a giant hassle to fund a loan. It's this like back and forth trail of paperwork. Like what's the deal? Is there a better option than me having to get you to initiate each loan and I'm filling out the investment directive for each loan? I mean, there's got to be a better way, right?
Yeah, so it really depends. I mean, there's really a few different ways to structure, you know, your self-directed account, and it really goes down to what you're going to use the money for. We have over 10,000 customers, and they run the gamut. I've got clients that have one investment, and I've got clients that have 50 investments in a year. The more active you are, the more advantageous setting up a checkbook control LLC becomes, whereby you can set up the LLC, direct the IRA, in this case through NewView, to fund the LLC, and then you as the IRA owner can go manage that LLC and go make the investments on behalf of the LLC, which is ultimately the IRA. And really, that's a great strategy if you're going to be active in the account, 3, 4, 5 investments a year. If you're going to do less than that, the LLC fees and the record keeping and tracking of the LLC and things you're now responsible for may not be worth the work and energy, but that's a decision you get to make. If you're doing one or two deals, it is best to probably just go through NewView and say, hey, here's my deal. What's the process? Fill out a few forms and let us fund it. We just find that for a couple of deals, it really doesn't make sense to add any extra effort. You can, if you qualify, and this is where that solo QRP comes in. The solo QRP is really, it's a 401k plan with built-in checkbook control. So if you have any form of self-employed income, you qualify. So you could establish the solo QRP. You don't have to go through NewView for anything beyond the plan docs, the establishment. But as far as setting up your own bank account, making your own investments, you can do all of that without the need of an LLC. So you don't have any additional LLC filing requirements, additional LLC fees. You just have a 401k and you go run it, and you get to manage all your own investments. So that plan is by far the best structure and strategy, regardless of what you're going to do. If you qualify, if you don't, then it really boils down to, you know, what's my activity going to look like? Am I going to passively write one loan a year? If so, let me just rely on NewView for that. If I'm going to be actively loaning out 6, 8, 10, 12 times a year, then yeah, put in the extra effort, spend a few extra bucks, set up your LLC, and then you don't have to go through NewView every time.
Got it. The solo QRP, is that the kind of thing, so I'm vaguely aware of this certain kind of self-employed way to have my company make this very large contribution to my IRA, and I haven't done this yet, so I'm probably not getting the facts correct. But let's say I have, you know, $200,000 right off the top. I'm at the highest tax bracket and I'd have like an S corporation and I want to chunk that whole 200K off into some kind of an IRA plan, like right now to the end of the year. I guess it's sort of like profits out of the business. It's the business contributing to the 401K that I'm setting up for myself as the only employee of that S corp. Is that like something I'm way off in the woods and don't have my facts straight, or is there some way to like methodically take a peel of the profit off the top if you're, you know, really killing it in business and you're not interested in paying all the taxes on that money just to keep it, but instead shelling it off into the savings for long term?
You're close. I mean, your premise is spot on. You know, just some clarification on the dollar amounts. So the way it works is really exactly how you describe from a standpoint of you've got a couple hundred thousand dollars of earnings, and whether you have 50 or 500, it doesn't matter. What matters is that your earnings are considered self-employed, right? You're subject to self-employment tax of some kind. In this case, you're filing as an S-corp. But at the end of the day, it meets their litmus test. Once you meet it, then it makes you self-employed, and you can set up a solo QRP, which is a regular 401k, for businesses that don't have any common law employees. So, Dan, you could take that and say, you know what? Yeah, I don't have an employer or employees. It's kind of me wearing both hats. I'm going to set this plan up. It allows you to, as an employee, put away $19,500. And don't quote me on the exact numbers. I'm within a few hundred. But it allows you to put nearly $20,000 dollar for dollar as the employee, and then as the employer up to 25% with a cap of like $57,000 or so a year. So what's really cool about this is, you know, even if you have a smaller amount of self-employed income, but you have other passive income, so maybe your income really for tax purposes is only $50,000. Well, the beauty is you can take $20,000 right off the top into the plan, right, dollar for dollar, and then you can take another 25% of the 50, which is 12,500, and you can get $32,500 bucks out of $50,000 of quote unquote self-employed earnings right into this plan. So it's fantastic if you're trying to save. It's fantastic if you want full control. It's fantastic if you may need to borrow from it at a later date personally, which IRAs don't allow. So there's some really cool plans or benefits of the plan. Bottom line is if you're self-employed, this thing trumps every IRA that's on the marketplace times 10. So if you have a dollar of self-employed income, I would strongly consider or strongly advise you to consider, you know, calling our office and really talking to us about this plan, because you won't find a better opportunity to save.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. With an eye on the clock, I did have one last little thing you could maybe button on here for us, and that would be, what are the types of investments that would be allowed? We already talked about like notes and mortgages. We talked about investing in LLC, and we talked about investing in real estate so far. Are there any other things that people are or should be aware of that might be candidates for their IRA to self-direct and invest in?
Yeah, so I'll answer that kind of two from two directions. So first is the IRS, you know, kind of approaches us what I refer to as the toddler rule, which is they don't really tell us what we can do. They tell us what we can't do, right? And for those with kids, you kind of understand that toddler stage. Don't do that. Don't eat that. Don't climb on that, right? It's easier than walking around telling them what they can do. And when it comes to self-directed accounts, you know, when Congress kind of wrote these laws and the IRS is charged to enforce them, they realize that they can't create this long laundry list of permissible investments. So instead, they created a list of prohibited investments, and it's small. It really, the only thing you can't do in an IRA is invest in a life insurance or collectibles, or invest anything that really is family related that's going to give you some tangible benefit outside of the tax benefits of the IRA. The list of what you can do, while not defined, we kind of answer based on what our clients do. And it really boils down into three asset classes. The first one is real estate. And when we say real estate, we've seen it all. You know, we talked about single family, multifamily, kind of rental type fix and flips. We have clients that own burial plots, boat slips, co-ops, you know, hunting leases. If you name it, you can do it. If it's deeded real estate, it can be held international or domestic. The second asset class is private loans. And this is where, you know, when we talked about kind of these hard money or private loans, which are really mortgages. We've seen personal notes, unsecured notes, lines of credit. We've seen credit facilities for businesses, mezzanine and construction financing. You name it. If it kind of has an interest rate and a maturity, you can do it, and it falls into the debt asset class. The third asset class is private equity. This is where, you know, any sort of private business investment, would fall. If you wanted to invest into your neighbor's lawn care business or the restaurant that's opening around the corner or whatever it may be, that's a huge business and industry. It actually represents we have as many clients from a dollar value in private equity as we do in real estate. But private equity also would include syndications, packaged up deals, which can be real estate in a lot of cases. But anything that's bought as an entity rather than the asset directly would fall under our private equity asset class. That's about 95% of what our clients hold. The other percentage, just not that it's not popular, it just pales in comparison in dollars, would be things like precious metals, cryptocurrency, tax liens, tax certificates. Got a client that owns a racehorse. That would be the more esoteric type investments.
Racehorse. You got to imagine. I mean, that one's got to be like right on, like the IRS is over there with the, you know, crooked eye looking at him like, yeah, the racehorse. And we're going to get an audit on that guy.
Yeah. I mean, the beauty of, you know, of self-direction, and I don't say this to invite people to try to commit fraud, but you know, we don't report holdings specifically. You know, we check a few boxes on our reporting of asset classes, so they may know you have a private equity or something unique or a closely held business or real property. But we don't tell them you own a house or you own a racehorse or you own anything unique. We just check boxes off that say, you know, the portfolio balance is 800 grand. And of that 800 grand, you know, public securities, private securities, and real estate are held. So not to say that it's a license to go misbehave, but the beauty is the IRS isn't really looking at these. That said, if this individual were audited, you better believe when they saw a racehorse in an IRA that they're certainly flipping down those big green visors and they're going to pull back that paperwork until they really understand what the client did.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, though. You say the private equity thing, and it's like on one hand, in my mind, I'm like, geez, the restaurant down the street just got shut down from COVID, and so did the local nightclub, and so did the, you know, and so it seemed like this kind of scary type of investment class. I mean, no, not for the multifamily businesses. I mean, that would, you know, multifamily large investments, syndication deals are probably the majority, but for somebody who is, you know, going to have their IRA money partner with the arm's length individual that they met who is a good chef and in a non-COVID environment and like have the IRA and the retirement own this chunk of a business. It's just pretty cool and something that I've been around the real estate thing a while, Jason. So normally I'm thinking notes, mortgages, syndications, fix and flips. Like I kind of have this like box, but that's cool that other type of, you know, businesses are also able to enjoy the investment vehicle that we have set up here. Cool. So what would be two book recommendations you would make to our audience here, Jason?
Well, these may be books that you have read, but they've been books that have been impactful in my life. The first one is Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki. You know, I think it's kind of like the elementary kind of approach to understanding how money really works. If you've not read it, take some time and read it. I can't recommend it enough. There's a few things in there that you can kind of gloss through. But overall, it simply paints the picture on really building wealth and getting ahead versus just simply, you know, working for the same company for 50 years and getting a gold watch and hoping that you saved enough for retirement and your managed mutual funds were successful. The second book I'd recommend is The Richest Man in Babylon. It is kind of tells the story of how to manage money through the Babylonians. And it takes it from, you know, and it illustrates that all the same things that we have, these shiny things that are always in front of us that we can go blow our money on, tend to be, you know, generally are fool's gold at the end of the day. And the real value in building wealth, you know, is understanding what money really is. And it's kind of a great story. If you've not read it, I'd encourage you to read it. Those two would be my two recommendations.
Nice. I'd second those. Read them both. Had similar takeaways there. If anyone has not yet, they would be on the list, right? I'm sure everyone's read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That's kind of the doorway into this whole realm of wealth building for most of us out here. Jason, if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself, I don't know, 15 years ago, your younger self, what would that be?
Well, you know, it's something that I actually try to remind myself all the time. You don't know what you don't know. And as cliche as that is, you know, we all have a level of ego and arrogance that tells us that we get a little bit of smarts and we think we have a lot of smarts. We get a little bit of anything and we think we have a lot of it. And I have learned that every bit of experience that I learned through others is great because I get the lesson without the experience. And everything that I kind of think I know and try to go out and execute on without any sort of, you know, understanding of not knowing what I don't know, I get the experience and the lesson. And a lot of those experiences are painful, and they're very expensive lessons to learn. And so sometimes we just got to get out of our own way and surround ourselves with people that are smarter than us. And it doesn't, you know, ignorance is bliss. The good news is ignorance is curable. Stupidity, unfortunately, is not. But learning from other people's mistakes is the most effective way to learn lessons. And just knowing what you don't know and being willing to look at a deal or an investment or anything in life and figuring out who do I know in my social circle that probably knows more about this than I do. It'd be the best lunch you ever bought. Gives you time to catch up and gives you a chance to ask, what am I missing here? And what have you learned that you can help me, with before I go through this process?
Yeah, as you say that, I'm like holding my head in embarrassment at like my first, probably my first 5 years in the real estate business. And I was like young and had a lot of bad habits and challenges, you know, growing up that I was able to like shed. But, you know, I probably did 10 deals and we brought in, you know, a couple $100,000. And I thought it was like, you know, like I knew it all and like I didn't bother keeping my mind open to, even looking for the wisdom and the experience from other people. And this is a time before podcasts, no bigger pockets. And, you know, you had to find books and be recommended books usually by people that you happen to come in contact with back in those earlier days here of real estate where we're blessed not to be, but great, great, jewel of wisdom for sure. So Jason, if anybody would like to get some more information about you or New View Trust or IRA, where can they go?
Easiest way to get to us is newviewtrust.com, and it's Newview with a U, N-U-V-I-E-W, trust.com. There's plenty of information there. You can go onto our blog section, and it's chock full of content, kind of going back to that. You don't know what you don't know. You know, spend a few hours on the site looking through some content, and there's certainly going to be some nuggets of wisdom that you can gather, you know, either by New View or third parties that we brought in to help curate some educational content.
All right, cool. Ton of wisdom here. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Jason, blocking out the distractions and give us your time. Great episode. Thanks.
Hey, Dan, thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can also sign up to receive new episode notification emails at reidiamonds.com, as well as check out the 169 episode archive of Wealth Building, Real Estate Investment Jewels of Wisdom. I've made millions of dollars by using the wisdom shared on the show over the last few years. I hope you can too. That website is reidiamonds.com. So my main business is buying and selling houses. 223 houses bought and sold in 2019 and 219 houses bought and sold so far in 2020. And we currently have another 133 houses in our inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold, awaiting closing. So here are three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, if you buy houses in Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, go to dealswithroi.com and sign up for the correct buyers list there. As of this recording, there are five lists in total separated by region, so be sure that you are on the correct page when signing up to receive that local area's deals. Number two, if you're an accredited investor and you'd like to fund a deal or many deals, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. Number three, if you have a deal for sale in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. So what is the number one mailing list for off-market deals in terms of ROI, your best return on investment? Don't laugh at the answer. Your in-house, self-developed, driving for dollars list is the number one hands-down winner. Think about it. Only houses that need repairs, look vacant, and or are totally outdated end up on that list. And no other investor has that same list, so you have lower competition. The issue is keeping the list organized, tracking your driving routes so that you don't double drive over the same area twice, miss streets, etc., looking up the addresses for owners, then researching the equity, and then even processing the mail campaign. So I found a source that is better than the spreadsheets and Google Map and disjointed system. If you go to www.reidealmachine.com, you can sign up for free to access the app and software for developing your own high ROI exclusive driving for dollars list and deal machine. So the website again is www.reidealmachine.com. So we are at the end, my friend. Next up, we have a special sneak peek behind the strategy of the REI Diamond Show, first ever, with content marketing strategist Lindsay Phillips. As a bonus on that next one, if easily raising a ton of capital to do real estate deals sounds like something that you'd be interested in, be sure to tune in next time. Until then, keep closing deals, and I'll catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.